jeez. Wow. Whew. God. My name's Morgan. I'm an alcoholic. And, gosh, now I'm, like, afraid to disappoint or something. It gets, like, really overwhelming. No, thanks for asking me to speak. Those of you who had to hear me on Monday, I'm really sorry. You gotta hear me again. But, you know, I pray just like I always do before I speak, because it's really easy for me to let my ego get involved when I speak, and for me to want to portray this, like, perfect picture of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to make you think that, like, I'm AA superwoman, and the truth is, I'm at this place in my sobriety, and it's a place, you know, that my sponsor says is absolutely normal, where I'm realizing how little I know. How little I know about sobriety and how little I know about living a principled life. You know, there's a lot I do know, but I mean, there's just still so much to learn. And, my sobriety date is July 24th, 2005. I have a sponsor and I sponsor others. And, those are all things that are very important to me. I have a home group, and it's this one, and I do believe it's one of the best groups in the world. I have another group that I'm working with in Lakeland that's also one of the best groups in the world, so I can't say, you know, I don't like to pick and choose, but I'll tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now, because that's where the change has taken place. You know, all my old friends are still doing the same stuff they've always been doing. All the old situations are still there. I was just in Tallahassee recently, and it hasn't changed a bit. For me, I was born in Newport News, Virginia, and we moved to Polk County when I was, like, not even a month old, and that's where I grew up the rest of my life, was in the middle of Florida. It's really hot, and there's not a whole lot to do, and my dad's in the military, my mom's a nurse, but when I was little, my mom was a waitress, and then she went into nursing school when I was a little kid, and my brother was even younger. And with my dad being in the military, he was an Army reservist, but he was gone a lot. He was always active duty. He was always living somewhere else. My mom chose not to move with my dad because she wanted us to have, like, the most normal life possible. And so she stayed, and my dad just moved. He moved everywhere. They've been married 25 years, and they figured out that he's been gone for, I think, 15 of those years they've been married. And so my dad really wasn't around growing up, you know, which for a long time I, like, victimized that for sure. Like, I totally used that to feed my alcoholism. My dad was never there. You know, I'd always play that card. And the truth is, I knew my dad loved me. I knew my dad was doing what he thought was best for the family, and it was not like I was abandoned. My mom was always there for me. My grandparents helped raise me, and I was surrounded by people who loved me. Nobody in my immediate family has alcoholism. I'm the only one in my immediate family. Lots of alcoholics and addicts in the surrounding family members, but I'm the only one in my family. But I grew up, you know, a very sheltered life. My mom put me in private school, just like Andrew. I relate to Andrew's story a lot. I didn't know about drugs or alcohol. My parents never drank around me. My mom every now and then would have, like, a glass of wine, and then she'd go to bed. So that was my experience. Like, and it didn't do anything magical for her. It didn't make her a happier person. My mom was always a very positive person, still is, almost to the point where it's irritating. You know, like, you know, those people who are just so positive, you're like, you never have a bad day. Like, you just want to, like, shake them. But, you know, my mom's always just been a very positive, very God-centered woman. And I envied her for that. And it took me a long time to realize why I hated my mom. But for me, my drinking didn't start until high school. I was about 15 years old, and honestly, until high school, I didn't know anything about, you know, drugs or alcohol. Oh, I forgot to tell you guys, I had an eye patch when I was growing up, so that made me feel really different. That was like my token thing, like, oh, I felt different because I had an eye patch. But the truth is, I was born cross-eyed, not cross-eyed, I had a lazy eye, which is cross-eyed. And on top of that, like, because I had an eye patch, I had bifocals, big Coke bottle model glasses that was like bifocals, and then the eye patch, but it had a bear on it because they tried to make it look cute, but it really wasn't. And so then, you know, I had the glasses that wrapped around your ears so you couldn't pull them off your face. And on top of that, my mom put this glasses strap on, like this like spandexy glasses strap all the time, not just when I played sports. Like, I wore it all the time. And so in order to keep the glasses strap from getting tangled in my hair, she had to cut my hair really like in a mullet fashion. So like I had a mullet with an eye patch and bifocals, and on top of that, I was like 2 feet shorter than ever. Well, like not 2 feet, probably like a foot and a half shorter. Like, my kindergarten pictures are really amazing. I look like a small person, like a little person. And at one point they even tested me to make sure I didn't have growth problems, but you know, I'm just tiny, and that's how it was. And I remember in kindergarten copying my first resentments on the playground. You know, I remember always being the baby when we'd play house on the playground and just being so mad. Like, but I want to be the mom. And everyone's like, no, you have to be the baby. And I was like, oh, like, I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I remember, like, looking at other girls and thinking, man, I wish I had Ashley's hair. Or I wish I was as tall as Julie, you know, and just like always from a very early age, like just wanting to be somebody else, somewhere else, doing something else, like never being comfortable with where I was at. I started Catholic school when I was 3 years old and all through high school. And it wasn't until I was about 15, I was real, real sheltered, until high school. Catholic high school is very different from Catholic elementary school. And that's with any high school. No matter where I would have been, I would have found those people. But I went to Wisconsin, and I was visiting my family up there, and there's not a whole lot to do in Wisconsin besides party. Even if there was, I would have done the partying anyways once I found it. So I went to this party with my cousin, and she said, we're going to go to a party. It's a going away party for you. But it really wasn't. Like, it was a party for some guy who was like going overseas, but she told me it was for me, so I would feel better about it. Because I wasn't leaving for a week, so it didn't make any sense. But I went to this party, and we pull up, and like, I've never been to a party like this before. You know, we pull up, and there's like 60 cars, and the music is blaring, and it's real loud, and I hear the bottles clashing, and I see the people coming in and out of the house, and it's a two-story log cabin. I mean, it's huge, and it's out in the woods, like real woods. I'm immediately just like struck with fear, paralyzing fear. So we go in, and the guy's like, what do you want to drink? And I've never had any kind of alcohol. I've never even tasted alcohol. And so I tell him I want a Coke, and he laughs at me because they obviously are not going to have Coke at a party like that. But he gave me this malt beverage called Hooch, and he was like, oh, this is kind of like Coke, and he gave it to me, and I tasted it, and I was immediately, like, disgusted. I was like, this is nothing like Coke, you know? It was some, like, orangey, like, Smirnoff icy kind of drink. Like, it was awful. I hate sweet drinks. Like, I hate sweets. I've never been a sweets kind of girl. I've always liked, well, I'm not going to say it. You know what I mean. Like, but anyways, so, wow, that was going to come out really bad. Anyways, so I never really liked sweets, and this drink was incredibly sweet. Like, it got you right here. And so... Oh, I love when I pray for God to like come in, because I never know what I'm going to say. And I don't think God would have said that either. But anyways, so back to the story. I end up getting drunk. The only reason I really get drunk, and it really happened by accident, I didn't want people to see me not drinking. I didn't want people to know that I had never drank before. I didn't want to stick out like a sore thumb. I drank the first time to fit in. That's why I drank. I had no idea what alcohol could do for me. I didn't drink for any other reason other than I did not want you to know I hadn't drank before. And then it was like every time I drank after that, I drank to that effect. And that's why I drank. Because immediately after about three of them, all the fear I had had coming into that social situation, the fear of what you thought about me or not fitting in, was gone. after a few drinks, like, I just don't care what you think about me, who I hurt, what I do. It's like, it's just freeing to not have to worry about anything. And so I proceeded to keep drinking. I was like, well, if three makes me feel like this, imagine what six is going to do. And when six came around, imagine what nine is going to do. And before I know it, I'm blacked out my first time drinking. And I wake up the next morning after being blacked out, and my pants are wet, and I'm in the back seat of a beat up old car, and I'm passed out, and it's winter and it's cold. And my cousin's running around looking for me, and my pants are ripped, and my back hurts. And I'm like, well, what? You know, what happened? And so I ended up figuring out that my pants were wet because I had peed myself, which was pretty cool. And I was passed out, and I still don't know whose car I was passed out in, but there was two other people, so I'm guessing it was safe. And two other people, I had no idea who they were, but you know, and my back was sore because I had fallen off the two-story roof on my back. And I found that out later because I don't remember that, obviously. Some guy convinced me there was a meteor shower going on the roof. And I was the girl that when I was drunk, I was like, really? Stars? Like, I would go. Like, it could be like a cloudy night. And I'd be like, yeah, stars, you know? And you guys know those guys. You know those guys are like, yeah, there's a meteor shower, but there wasn't. And anyways, I fall. And the reason I go into such graphic detail of my first drink, of my first, like, drunk, is because that's pretty much how every drunk after that went. I almost always blacked out, almost always peed or relieved myself in inappropriate places, as Pam says. And then I almost always, you know, hurt myself or hurt somebody I love. And that night I also was the first night I ever smoked pot, so first night I smoked cigarettes, and it was the first night I cheated on a significant other. And, you know, it just started this, like, it started this, I loved that. I'm not going to tell you I didn't love that. I loved not caring. I loved not caring about who I was hurting. It was almost like I lived my life during my drinking career by this rule of, well, if I don't remember it, then it just doesn't count or it didn't happen. And the problem with that is when I wake up the next morning, my parents, you know, even if my parents hadn't raised me with morals, like, my parents raised me with good moral values, and I knew what I was doing was wrong. When I would sober up in the morning or even just come to, I would be absolutely disgusted with myself. And I would loathe myself. And I remember looking in the mirror and just, like, wanting to die. You know, just hating who I was. And, but, you know, I got through high school. I was dating this guy before my first drunk who was, like, really nice. I was dating him for, like, 2.5 years. You know, we were going to get married and everything. And he was a virgin and he was a star baseball player and all this stuff. And my mom loved him. And in return, that means, like, I hated him. You know, like, if my mom liked you, I hated you. You know, if my mom approved, I was pretty much just not going to date you. And that was because I started forming this huge resentment at my mom. And a lot of it was my mom could see that I was going in a direction she didn't want me to go. And I didn't want to hear it. And so I graduated high school with honors, and I was really able to manage my drinking throughout high school. It was kind of just a weekend thing back then. But even when I drank on the weekends, I blacked out. And when I graduated, I got offered a full ride to a private school in town. But I also got into this other college that was like 4 hours away, and it was number 2 in Playboy magazine for party schools, and I was like, man, that's the school. So, like, instead of taking this free offer to go to school, they're going to pay for me, they're going to pay for everything, I'm like, no, I think I'm going to pay for school and go 4 hours away. And the only reason I went to that school is because I knew I could drink the way I wanted to drink. You know, I used to lie and tell people, but they just have such a great educational program because I wanted to be a teacher, and that's why I'm going there. And the truth of the matter is I went there because it was far away. I was out of my parents' reach, and I knew I could do what I wanted to do. And that's what ended up happening. My roommate from Tallahassee, she lived with me the whole time I was there, 2.5 years. We were talking about the first time she met me. I was sober. But that night after she had met me, she carried me into my bed. And, you know, what a first impression. I don't know why she kept living with me. But, you know, we were talking about how in the dorm she would meet whoever I was with downstairs, and she would help me up into my room and then into my bed. And my bed was one of those, like, high-up beds. Like, it had, like, it was probably four... Well, let me see. It was about 4 feet high. And, it was about 4 feet high. And, when I was drunk, I would, like, when I was sober, I would run and just, like, lift myself gracefully into it. But then, like, when I was drunk, right, there's nothing graceful about me when I'm drunk. So I would run and go to get in my bed, and I would just, like, bounce off the side and wake up in the morning with, like, a huge bruise. And so my roommates, like, finally convinced me to buy a ladder. to get into my bed just for when I was drunk, you know? And my thing was, well, the bed wasn't so high, but I had no problem getting into that bed sober. You know, but it was just one of those things. And so anyways, I also in high school started this habit of dating guys that that wouldn't talk to me about my drinking. You know, I dated a lot of guys that sold drugs. I dated a lot of guys that had fake IDs. I dated a lot of guys that were into credit card fraud. I dated people who were as sick as I was, because I knew if I dated somebody healthy, they would have a problem with the way I was living. And I used to say, like, oh, you know, I just got in all these abusive relationships. That was my, you know, my card when I got here. I got in all these abusive relationships, but I put myself in those. And I was free to leave whenever I wanted to. I got something out of those relationships, and what I got was I got to be drunk. You know, most of them, you know, drugs are a little part of my story. They're not a huge part of my story, but I got drugs for free. And basically, you know, you can call it, I don't know. I mean, I didn't pay for a lot of drinks. You know, I don't know what you want to call that, but I sold myself. I sold my soul to drink the way I wanted to drink. And that was not who I was. That was not how I raised, but that's what I did, how I was raised. And so anyways, I ended up breaking up with this guy that I was, like, dating for 2.5 years. We weren't really dating. We'd just get drunk and hook up. And but when we broke up, I was devastated, right? Because all my emotion, like, he was my higher power, pretty much. I didn't have anything, no God in my life. And I immediately started dating this other guy. And after, like, 2 weeks of hanging out, he convinced me that I was paranoid schizophrenic. And and it made absolute sense. I was so crazy. I mean, because of the boyfriends I'd had before, I started dating this one guy, and he was a narc. And so people started following him around. They found out he was selling people out for drugs or for a plea bargain or whatever. And then I started dating this other guy who was in credit card fraud. So I was convinced the cops had gotten into my roommates. Like, my roommates were working for the cops now. And I was telling him how my roommates were with the cops and how I can't even eat the food in my house because my roommates are poisoning it. And he looked at me and he's like, you know, my sister's bipolar and I think you're paranoid schizophrenic. And I was like, okay, yeah. Like, I totally believed it. I totally believe it and bought it. Absolutely 100% true. And the insanity of my alcoholism is immediately from that point, and this is just how my alcoholism worked, I immediately assumed that my parents had known I was schizophrenic my whole life, but had been keeping it from me. And then even further than that, they let me go to Florida State, because Florida State was actually a school for schizophrenic people, and everybody else was observing me, right? So I convinced myself of this thoroughly, and I locked myself in my room. I locked myself in my room for, I think, like, it was at least 3 or 4 days. I didn't eat, because, like I said, my roommates were poisoning my food. I stopped drinking, because I really thought, I knew alcohol was making my paranoia worse, but I could not stop smoking pot. And, you know, which makes no sense. And looking back, I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? But it made sense to me at the time. I'm like, pot just calms me down. But it made me so much more paranoid that, you know, like, I lived in filth at this point, too. Like, I don't want to make my drinking sound glamorous at all, you know, and I can laugh about it today, but, like, the way I was living was disgusting. You know, I was not the cute girl with the martini glass. You know, I was the girl who was, like, puking right outside the door of the bar. I was the girl who was puking on the bar. You know, I was the girl who was peeing between the trucks. Like, it was not, like, it was not cute. And, but the way I was living in my house, I hadn't showered in like, a week and a half because I just could not, I didn't care about myself enough to do that. I didn't respect myself enough to do that. I hadn't eaten, and I have a low blood sugar disorder. I'm hypoglycemic, and when I don't eat, it makes me loopy, and on top of the paranoia, I mean, it just did not help. And on top of that, like, I have empty beer bottles, I have food containers. My roommate remembers that when they took me to the hospital, she found, like, cups of milk that were, like, curdled. I mean, it was disgusting. It was disgusting. And, I don't know who called. I thought it was my roommate Blanca for the longest time, but one of my friends at the time called my mom and was like, there's something really wrong with Morgan. She hasn't come out of her room. She hasn't eaten. I don't know what's wrong, but I think you guys should come up here. My parents made the trip. It's 4.5 hours, which is 4.5 hours for my mom to stew about what she's about to find. And, I knew my parents were coming because at this point I, like, listen at the door to everybody's conversation because I'm convinced I'm going to hear something that's going to reaffirm my paranoia. So I'm always at the door like this. And so I know my parents are coming. I have 4.5 hours to clean up my room, and I just can't do it. I can't do it. I just didn't have it in me. And my parents get there, and at this point I've accumulated a bunch of exotic pets. That was another weird thing I did. Like, either in a blackout or, like, hungover the next morning, I would, like, convince myself that it was a really good idea to buy, like, all these exotic animals. And so I have terrariums in my room, and I have, like, an albino corn snake in one, and I have a Pac-Man frog that's, like, this big and eats mice over here. And then I have emperor scorpions under a black light. I mean, it was just, like, you would look at my room and be like, yep, she's definitely, like, mentally ill or something. And the Pac-Man frog had been dead for about a week and a half, because I couldn't feed it. Cost $1 a week to feed that animal. I mean, it was like, you'd have to be, like, stupid not to keep this animal alive. But I couldn't do it. I was absolutely incapable of caring for any life form. I mean, it was just sad. And my parents got there, and after about 5 minutes of knocking on the door, I let them in, and my mom, first of all, was just pissed. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. It was just mad. So mad at me because I wasn't raised that way. And my dad looks in my room and looks around, and he's just horrified. He's horrified, and he starts bawling. My dad just starts crying his eyes out. You know, it was really easy for me to hide how I was living from my parents because they live 4.5 hours away. And when my parents came face to face with how I was living, I remember, you know, the look on my dad's face, like, Andrew, I'll never forget that look. And more than that, like, I'll never forget looking at my dad crying and thinking, what is wrong with you? You know, like, that was my thought. Like, there's nothing wrong with the way I'm living. Like, clearly there is. Like, you look in my room and there's, like, food and disgustingness everywhere, and I don't think that's the word, but, you know, like, it was just filthy. And on top of that, I'm like 95 pounds. I'm sunken in. I have no light in my eyes, you know, and I'm wobbling because I haven't eaten in 3 or 4 days. And so my parents put me in the car, and they're going to drive me to the hotel near my apartment, and they're just going to talk to me and whatever. And after about 10 minutes of talking to me, my mom starts heading to Lakeland. And they were going to keep me in Lakeland for the weekend. That was the plan. What they thought is, was somebody slipped something in my drink, and that's what was going on. And so after what ended up happening is, it's 4.5 hours, I told my parents my whole fist up. And it was absolutely horrible. What I thought was going to happen, and this is all dicey. I mean, I was in and out of consciousness. I mean, but I just remember my mom saying, Morgan, just shut up. Like, stop talking. Just stop talking, Morgan. Like, I don't want to hear anymore. you know, just go to sleep, try and close your eyes, just shut up, you know. And at some point she was just yelling at me to shut up, and my dad's crying and his face is covered, and I can't stop talking. I can't stop just vomiting all this information on them. And you know, I told my parents everybody I'd slept with, every drug I had done, every rotten thing I had ever done in my life. And if you're new, you know, don't do that. Don't do that. Oh my gosh. I've had new girls come up to me and say, I really think I need to tell my mom my story. And I'm like, no, really you don't. It's okay. But you know, what I did at that point was I relieved my guilt. And the only way I knew how to do, and the only way I had, the only tool I had, was at the expense of my parents. And, my parents and I have a wonderful relationship today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it took a lot of time for that to heal. That caused a lot of damage. And by the time we got back to Lakeland, the plans had changed again. I wasn't going to the house. I was going straight to the hospital. And they admitted me through the ER to One South, which was the mental health / detox unit. And they weren't really sure which side to put me on. Like, they weren't sure if I was crazy or if I was a detox patient. So I kind of just floated. And they had to put me on IVs for a while. I was incredibly dehydrated. It took a while. They ended up giving me some glucose tablets and stuff because my blood sugar was incredibly low. And on top of this, oh my gosh, I always forget to tell this, but this was such a big, like, not a big thing, but like, I told my mom I had AIDS, and I don't. Like, and I'm not trying to make light of that, but I had convinced myself that I had it. And so I tell my mom that. I tell my mom, I'm like, Mom, I'm pretty sure, on top of being schizophrenic, that I have AIDS. And I tell my mother this, and my mother is just like she's just like overloaded, like, oh my God. And so now we're really making a sex inventory. Like, we're sitting down and we're writing down everybody I've ever done anything with. And they did an immediate test for that, and of course it came back fine. And my mom was just like, I don't know how my mom didn't get Baker acted throughout this whole thing, but like, like, it was just insane. And and what ended up happening is two different doctors pretty much preliminary diagnosed me with the onset stages of paranoid schizophrenia. And it runs in my family. I'm not trying to make light of it at all. Mental illness is very serious. You know, it affects a lot of people, and it affects my family in many ways. And most people don't get diagnosed till they're in their 20s, and I was 19. And so they thought that's what was happening. It tore my family apart because we've watched my aunt struggle with it for so many years. And this one therapist, I'll never forget her, she comes in on her little scooter, and she's rolling around, and she has these huge glasses and big fake wig, and she's a heavyset lady, and she goes, she talks like the women off Coffee Talk on Saturday Night Live skit, you know, like, I'm all verklempt, like those ladies, like, she talks exactly like that. And somehow, she was just a therapist, you know, she wasn't a doctor, she wasn't anything, but she somehow convinced those doctors to let me go into her intensive outpatient program. On the contingency, there was a catch, that if I was not better after 7 weeks, that I was to be readmitted to the hospital and be treated for paranoid schizophrenia. And I didn't find that out until I was 9 months sober that woman did that. I didn't find out until I was 9 months sober that they thought I was schizophrenic either. I don't think they wanted to tell me because they knew I was already convinced of it. And but I went into her outpatient program, and but I didn't go there right away. They kept me in detox for 10 days. And in detox, there was this other alcoholic. He was the only other alcoholic there. He was this guy named Gus, and I'll never forget him. He was 75, 80 or something, and he was your classic, I guess you would call him borderline wet brain. I mean, he would sit there, and I would sit with him because he was the only semi-normal one, and we would watch the cars go by, and he would be like, Chevy, Ford, and he would just like name off all the cars, and I would just sit there with him, and his wife would call every week, and he would forget he had a wife. And I remember that guy. I'll never forget that guy. Like, I don't know what happened to him. I remember he had a home, but he didn't know he had a home. I mean, it was just sad. And, you know, I went to the meeting. I went to an AA meeting and detox. And then when I got out, I went to this outpatient program, and they required you to go to AA or NA meetings. And I went to both. And I found my home in Alcoholics Anonymous. Drugs were a part of my story, but they didn't do what alcohol did for me. They never did what alcohol did for me. What ended up happening is that when I first started going to meetings, started going to this noontime meeting, and I was paranoid that they were poisoning the coffee, because I was still paranoid for like 60 days into sobriety. I mean, it was insane. And so they made me the coffee maker, and I started making the coffee for that meeting. And I got my first sponsor at that meeting. And then shortly after that, I met a girl who's actually here tonight, Bethany, and I met her at the Young Sober and Free meeting. And the first woman I actually asked to sponsor me, she died 3.5 weeks ago of an overdose. And it's crazy. But Bethany plugged me in with these women that had like numerous years of sobriety. I mean, double digit sobriety, 30, 40, 20. One woman was like 48 years sober. She's now 52 years sober. But, and I remember like Bethany was like, yeah, we're going to go to this meeting. And I was like, okay, I don't have anything else to do. I'll go with you. And we ended up meeting at the 2720 Club out in Lakeland. And, this woman pulls up in her minivan, and I'm already like, oh, shit. And then there's like two other women. There's two other women in the car, and they're both on oxygen. And I'm looking around, and I'm just like, this is not what I had in mind, Bethany. But we get in the car, and I sit in the back with this woman, Cherry, who had about a year. And the rest of the women in the car have, like, double-digit sobriety. And Bethany, of course, jumps in the other truck so she can smoke, so she leaves me all alone with these old-timers, right? And I started to do what I had always done, and I started to rationalize and make excuses for why I was the way I was. And I started to tell these women my sob story. And about how, you know, I never had a dad, and about, you know, all the abusive relationships I had signed up for. I mean, like, all this stuff. And what happened is these women, like, gently and not so gently broke down my rationalizations. You know, they made me see the truth about myself. They didn't allow me to make excuses for my behavior. You know, they pointed out that I drank because I liked what alcohol did for me. I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't drink to cover up all that stuff I thought I was covering up. I drank because I liked the way alcohol made me feel. And all that other stuff was just rationalizations for why I drank that way. And so we ended up riding this meeting out in Avon Park, which is like 2 hours away. And I'm not going to tell you that, like, on that ride out there that I immediately wanted what these women had, because I was looking around the car, and, like, there's one woman with, like, 48 years, and I'm looking at her like, you probably don't need to go to meetings anymore. You know what I mean? Like, 48 years, you're probably good. You know, you can probably stop going to meetings. It's a little bit overkill at this point. Like, really, you're good. And then the other women, we all went out to dinner afterwards, and the other women were joking about their past, and they were laughing about things that like tore me up, you know, things that like I couldn't look in the mirror because of the things they were laughing about, you know. And at first I was like, oh my gosh, like I can't believe I'm making light of such serious things. And but then what I realized is like these women are totally free of their past, and for the first time like ever I wanted something that AA had, that the people in AA had. And there was this one woman in that group of women that I absolutely hated, and that was because she said I looked like I was 12 years old and I was 19, and I was just absolutely appalled that she would talk to me that way. And she was really coarse and really rough and not very nice. And she was one of the women who was like, you probably shouldn't talk at the meeting. And I was like, oh, you know, I was just like disgusted. I was so upset with her. And I ended up walking the lake with her, like 3 times a week for the first year of my sobriety. And she was the one woman I said, I will never ask her to be my sponsor. I will never hang out with her. She will never be my friend. And she's my sponsor today. She's been my sponsor for the past three and a half years. And, you know, for me, you know, I didn't do everything perfect my first year. I got involved in a relationship because I thought it was going to be different for me. And really that's nowhere in the book. It's just a valuable suggestion, which I failed to heed. I didn't drink, came close. I also didn't do my steps. I didn't get into my steps right away. I got into my steps around 8 or 9 months sober. And the only reason I got into my steps was because the guy I was dating at the time was actually passing me, and he was only a month sober, right? So, like, my ego was like, no. He cannot beat me in the steps. So I started, like, jumping into my steps. And, you know... I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, I haven't always done things for the right reasons, but I've done them. I haven't always done them perfect, or, you know, maybe the right way. I don't even think that there is a right way, but it's just showing up here, doing the work. You know, if you're new, get a sponsor. I don't know where I am on time. 10 minutes, okay. But for me, it's been real important for me to be in the middle of AA. I've been on both extremes. I've been on the extreme where I've done nothing for AA, and then I've been on the extreme where I do too much in AA, and my personal relationships suffer. And I think as alcoholics, it's a constant struggle to kind of find that middle ground. But it was so important for me to work the steps with my sponsor, and it's so important for me today to take other girls through the steps. You know, my sponsor went through, we went through and went over my fourth step, and it was the first time I'd ever been honest with anybody in my entire life, and there were those things, like Andrew said, that I didn't want to tell anybody, and I told her anyways, and you know, what AA has done is it's removed, you know, people say, like, AA has given me all this stuff, and yeah, AA has given me a lot, but, like, more so, AA has removed all this stuff from me that completely blocked me off from God and from all you people, and all this junk, all this garbage that I had inside that I didn't think could ever go away is gone. Not to say I can't pick it back up and play with it every now and then because I get in a little self-pity. But I mean, it's gone. You know, I don't have that junk feeling anymore. And, you know, I recently gotten involved with the special needs movement at a district level, trying to provide, you know, individuals with special needs accommodations for meetings. You know, like, for the deaf members, interpreters, and stuff like that. And there's so, and I guess, for me, it's finding, you know, what it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, what area, what level of service I want to do, what area I feel the most comfortable in, and what I'm passionate about. And I went back to school at about a year of sobriety, and now I teach. And I love it. I love my kids. I can't believe people trust me with their kids. I always say that because it's still so amazing to me. Like, I remember babysitters would ask me to not come back. And, you know, like, people trust me with their kids today, and they value my opinion when it comes to that. And for me, it all started with Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely could not live my life the way I was living anymore. I was running myself into the ground. I was miserable. And AA taught me to suit up, show up, even when I don't want to. And therefore, I do it at work. I do it with my family because I don't want to show up for my family does a lot of stuff together. And sometimes I'm just like, oh, enough. And but I show up anyways because there was a lot of years I wasn't there. And I don't know. I mean, recently, to be honest, I got on this part in my sobriety where I really stopped praying. I stopped praying. I stopped meditating. It got really uncomfortable really fast. And I know that I'm supposed to live 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis, but I wasn't doing it for a good, probably 2.5 months. I was just off. And I've been getting back to that. I've been getting back to what I know works, you know, and that's taking that time out in the morning and at night at least. And sometimes, you know, on my lunch break now, when I'm frustrated at work, but thoroughly looking at my day and talking to my sponsor about it. My sponsor's been working with me on omission. I tend to omit things, thinking it's not a lie. Like, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm just not going to tell you the whole truth. And it's lying, either way you look at it. So that's been a defect I've really been working on, but praying to remove and working on it, truthfully. I've been trying to be as honest and as thorough as I can be with my sponsor. Like I said, if you're new, you know, you don't have to do it perfect, but there are a lot of people in here that are willing to help. And I hope, you know, you have that gift of desperation that I had, because I was almost willing to do just about anything when I got here, because I hated the way I felt. But that's about all I got. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay, Lindsay's going to read Dr. Bob's last message. I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Bob's last message. I get a big thrill of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with the feeling that possibly something I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all got the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not loose it all up with fruit and complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into these words, love and service. We understand what love is and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.